Welcome to the podcast States and Migration in Europe. I am Dr. Emmanuel Conte. This podcast explores hot topics involving states and migration in Europe. Today, we are discussing the question, does Salafism lead to jihadism? There is this question of the cultural incompatibility of migrants. That is, there are though the opponents to the free movement of people would put forward that there can be conflicts of cultures, clashes of cultures among migrants and natives, and that migrants can also become violent against natives. And in this line of reasoning, the question of Salafism and jihadism is going to be prominent. So we want to understand if in this extreme case, there is a connection between something which is part of the culture of immigrants, namely a certain variant of Islam, the Salafism, and potential conflicts between natives and immigrants, as could be embodied by jihadism as it had become known in the West. So to discuss this question, I am very honored to have with me my friend Mohamed Ali Adraoui, who is a prominent expert of Salafism. Mohamed has just published a book on this question, Understanding Salafism in the Sciences Po series in International Relations and Political Economy, available with Palgrave Macmillan. So, Mohamed, welcome. So, please tell us first, what is Salafism?
Well, Emmanuel, thank you very much. First of all, thanks for inviting me. I'm very glad to be part of this podcast. Salafism, broadly speaking, refers to a certain vision within Islam. So we are talking about the Islamic religion. And of course, many debates do exist. But one way of looking at Salafism is looking at Salafism as a very puritanical, fundamentalist, orthodox vision of the Islamic faith. Basically, Salafism refers to a word in Arabic, a Salaf. Salaf refers to the first generations of Muslims, the first Muslims who have ever lived, the first Muslims actually who have ever experienced actually the birth of this religion. They have learned their Islam, their religion, their faith from the Prophet Muhammad himself. So being a Salafi in this sense means that you want to try to reproduce, to restore what Islam was, in theory at least, when the Salaf were there. So a Salafi or a Salafist, for example, in English, is someone who wants to go back to the very first version of Islam. So this is theory, of course, and we have debates because this attempt to restore the so-called purity of Islam, actually, it has, in fact, de facto, many manifestations. It has many translations on the ground. Some people, they turn Salafism as a very, orthodox religion, where what does matter is what to do on a daily basis, for example. Some other people, they have a highly politicized understanding of Salafism. They create parties in order, for example, to seize power, to run for elections in some places. We have seen that in the Middle East, for example, in the last few years. And other people, other Salafists, they have a more violent understanding of this fundamentalist design, and they want to, through the concept of jihad, they want to go at war with their enemies.
So, yeah, let's go back now to this connection between Salafism and going to war. Can you better explain to me why going back to the root of Islam, to the first generation of Muslims, can, as you just said, lead to going to war for Islam?
So it doesn't mean that they necessarily want to go to war. Actually, here we are talking, I mean, if I have to define Salafism clearly, as once again, this is a puritanical fundamentalist vision of this religion, as it is understood today by Salafists, that we can find in so many countries across the globe. from Europe to the Middle East, from Asia to North America, from Africa to Central Asia, we can find Salafist communities. They are not necessarily the majority. They don't represent necessarily the majority of Muslims today, but still it's a visible, growing, let's say, understanding today due to globalization, due to many factors that I would be happy to tell you about in a few minutes if you're interested. So that's the global narrative, going back to the very first versions of Islam, or what is supposed to be the very first version of Islam. However, in practice, some people today, I mean, in the contemporary era, they believe or they come to the conclusion that, for example, politics is not useful. They believe that being a true Muslim, a true Salafi Muslim, should lead you to ignore politics, for example. We have. It's, by the way, I think the vast majority of today's Salafists are, they believe so. They believe actually that ignoring politics or not paying attention to politics is actually the right understanding of Salafism. Some other people, they commit to politics. For example, they want to, they want their values, they want their principles, they want their ideas to prevail in the public sphere via, for example, a political party. They are going to be, for example, political Salafists, okay? They are going to participate into the political debate wherever they can, for example. We have seen that in many countries in the aftermath of the Arab uprisings several years ago, for example. Some other people, not only do they believe in politics, in a politicized version of Salafism, but they go as far as saying that violence is the only political tool through which they can restore their this very first version of Islam, or so-called very first version of Islam. So it's a debate, actually. Many Salafists, actually, they don't necessarily agree with each other. And this jihadi Salafist, actually, they believe that when they have an enemy, when the Islamic community has a problem, a political problem, a cultural problem, a religious problem, actually violence becomes justified, becomes legitimate in order actually to fix, to help the Muslim community. We have seen that in many conflicts, in Syria, in Afghanistan, in the past, for example, in Iraq, in Chechnya, wherever, for example, you have a conflict, so you have to help Islam seen as a nation, as a global nation. You have the jihadi or the jihadist organizations or movements, and they come into the game in order actually to help their fellow believers via this very violent understanding of Salafism. But it is an exception. That's not necessarily the vast majority of Salafists who do believe so.
Yeah, all right. That's very interesting. So there is nothing in Salafism that, I mean, from the doctrinal point of view, that calls necessarily for using violence to restore this original version of Islam. It's simple and simply that there are groups of Salafists who advocate violence to reach their goals, whereas others do not. But from the doctrinal point of view, there is no there is no necessity or no absolute references to violence as a mean to return to this initial stage of Islam.
At least there is no mechanical connection or relation between the two. It's not because it's not necessarily because you are a fundamentalist that you are going to be violent. And I would also add the other way around. It's not because you are violent that previously you have been a fundamentalist Muslim.
Yes, of course, yes. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the question then is, now, beside the doctrinal aspect and the theological aspect, from more the sociological point of view, where are the Salafists in the world today? Are they more represented among migrants or not, proportionally, of course? And what is the share of those you would consider have this appetite for violence in their defense of their faith? So where are they? And what is the proportion of those who you would consider violent?
That's a good question. That's two very good questions. The first one is, we can find Salafist communities wherever in the world, in the rest, in either it's in the Muslim majority countries or in the Muslim minority countries. For example, if you are aware of some debates in some countries in Europe, like France, like the Netherlands, like Spain, for example, today, some politicians, some leaders, some authorities, they are discussing, for example, the negative impact of Salafism within some migrants' communities. So, for example, in Spain recently, I mean, we have seen a Moroccan imam who was characterized as a Salafist imam, and he was actually expelled from the country because he was accused of spreading radical ideas, not necessarily violence, but at least, I mean, having a very, let's say, problematic understanding of Islam that would or that may harm actually the integration of some communities in Spain or some migrants communities from Morocco, for example. So we can find them wherever, I mean, almost where in many countries, anywhere in the world, for example, from the Gulf. Saudi Arabia is really important to understand the rise of Salafism in the 20th century. But it's also, and the people listening to us, they need to know and they need to have in mind that it's probably today one of the most globalized forms of Islam. So, for example, because Salafism is built on this idea of defending a so-called pure religiosity, it makes Salafism compatible with any culture, paradoxically. Because it's pure religion, at least in theory. You pray when you have to pray, you dress a certain way, you speak a certain way, there is right and there is wrong, there is what is allowed, there is what is forbidden. So actually, at least in theory, you can apply this framework to many cultures, many different cultures worldwide, for example. It's not like Salafism is really the enemy of traditions. Salafi people don't like traditions. They don't like cultural traditions. They don't like anthropological traditions, for example. They want pure religiosity that comes from their understanding of, for example, the Islamic scriptures. So that's why actually it's pretty easy to be a Salafist, contrary to what many people would believe, against all odds, actually, because you have this idea of a pure Islam that you can practice or put into practice in France, in Canada, in Indonesia, in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, for instance, in Morocco, in Nigeria, or wherever else. So you have thousands of Salafist communities. It's not a centralized movement. We are talking about autonomous communities that do not necessarily have connections with each other worldwide or even within one country. And if you want to talk about jihadists, people who may be violent or who advocate violence, for example, well, we can look at them as people who have tried to join certain organizations, like, for example, Al-Qaeda in some countries, like ISIS, that are some of the most famous, well-known jihadist organizations today. So it depends. But for example, in Syria, we, according to some studies in the Syrian conflict, until recently, we had up to 30,000, 35,000 fighters, actually, in these groups. So it's not that huge, of course, but it's enough, actually, to create violence and to spread chaos.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting point. So the characteristic of Salafism are, as you said, irrelevant to make it irrelevant whether you are in a Muslim majority country or in a Muslim minority country. That is, and therefore you can have Salafism actually more easily in when you are a Muslim immigrant than when you are in a Muslim when you have remained in your country of origin in a Muslim majority country. Did I get the point correctly? That is, I have the feeling that, I mean, I am wondering if as a migrant, because we're interested in that in this channel, if someone who leaves a Muslim majority country and goes to a Muslim minority country, do you think that this person may be more interested in Salafism than if they had not moved?
That's a tough question. I can say one thing, that if the people who have studied Salafism in the West, for example, like in Europe, in France, Britain, Germany, Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries, Norway, Spain, actually, they have mentioned, they have highlighted the fact that being a minority, sort of targeted community, for example, in some countries, it may lead actually to a very specific, let's say, kind of harsh understanding of religion, because you want to protect yourself. You see yourself as dominated. You see yourself as, that's not the only factor, but this is one factor that needs to be underlined. Actually, you see yourself, for example, if you are part of some marginalized communities, especially, for example, if you are a young person, I mean, if you are part of an Islamic youth or kind of youth that is marginalized, no real jobs, no real opportunities, well, it has an effect in terms of identity building. And sometimes the radical identities are, let's say, the winners when it comes to dealing with a very problematic relationship with the rest of the society. So Islam can be seen as a tool in order to restore some dignity sometimes. And the certain forms of Islam, like Salafism, for example, because you become, in terms of a very, by virtue of this very prestigious genealogy, you become the follower of the Prophet and of the Salaf. To if you allow me a word that is extremely popular today, you are the follower of a very prestigious tradition. You embody, you represent true Islam. So it's extremely, let's say, positive in terms of identity building. You become someone important. You become someone whose faith actually is the purest, the most genuine, the most authentic form of faith within Islam today, compared to other Muslims who are said to be weak, who are too modern. They have given up on many aspects of their religion. A Salafi Muslim could argue that he is the only one actually to be totally loyal to the very first, to the many expectations of Islam. So in some cases, we can argue that being a migrant or the child of a migrant or the grandchild of a migrant, it may reinforce a certain appeal to Salafism. But in reality, also in other countries, like Muslim majority countries, we also deal with a certain appeal of Salafism. So it's a complex issue, but for sure, when you are a minority, part of a minority, some people in the West have seen that Salafism is really appealing to the people who may have some problems with the rest of the society in terms of integration, in terms of discriminations, in terms of being well seen by the rest of the society.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. So the here you refer to the social conditions that Muslims face in their countries. That is, you developed a mechanism that Salafism, because it's flattering, or it gives you a sense of importance, can become a way to turn a situation of marginalization or even inferiorization in destination countries. So here is how certain trends or certain appeals within the religion interact with the social conditions of the faithful. And so I think that the mechanism is going to be even clearer if we are no longer interested simply in Salafism, but in the violent trend in Salafism. I understand in what you say that it's this trend for violence in Salafism may be more related, or is more related to the social conditions that Muslims face around them than to the actual Islamic scriptures. So, where are the violent forms of Salafism today in the world?
Well, it's a good question. First of all, I need to highlight one thing. So for many years, actually for many decades, we had a connection between Salafism and jihadism. At least at the sociological level, we had a sort of kind of trend that in some cases, the more rigoristic you were, the more likely you were actually to commit yourself to jihadism. There was a certain logic actually. You are very observant, you become very radical, and even to sometimes an extremist, and then you can go for violence. But it's even less and less the case actually. practically, in reality, many studies are showing today, or have been showing, that the issue of jihadism is getting something, is becoming sort of autonomous, in the sense that jihadism, this is basically one of the things that we can see in some places, that you can become a jihadist without any real Salafist background at the sociological level. So here I started with saying that you have many understanding of Salafism, and one of them is very violent, which is true historically. This is actually how some people have seen themselves in the past. But today, in the 21st century, in many countries across the globe, actually, you clearly see this disconnection between the two. And it's like jihadism is becoming an ideology in itself. That's why we have so many issues when we have to deal, for example, when public authorities in Europe, they have to deal with the issue of radicalization, because they are looking for some indicators of radicalism that they think they are going to find in the religious sphere. Like, you are observant, you don't drink alcohol, you don't shake women's hands. They are indicators of how radical you are becoming. So it's interesting, but does it work out on the ground? For example, today we have plenty of profiles of jihadi people, jihadi radicalized people, who have no, there were no indications actually that they have been Salafist before. So they go to Salafism without, or jumping over the Salafist stage, if you allow me this expression. Now, the jihadists, do we know where they are? Well, they are where basically the fighting is done in some places, like, for example, in Syria until recently, in Afghanistan, I mean, in the 80s, that's basically where everything has started, with the rise of Al-Qaeda. People with, like, bin Laden, for example, at the time, they have been the first generation of jihadi fighter, global jihadi fighter, for example. But also in Africa today, we have in Mali, in Cameroon, in Nigeria, in countries like that, we have a reinforcement of jihadist groups there because of many factors that we could deal with. But clearly here we have an idea of a certain global insurrection. There is a kind of pattern of the model. Every time you have a conflict, you have foreign fighters coming up, but also domestic fighters that are jihadized. They stick to jihadism, they embrace the jihadist narrative, and they turn an initial conflict which is not religious into a more religious, more radical conflict. For example, we have seen that in Syria, and also because the government Assad wanted this strategy. They wanted actually to disqualify, to discredit the uprising, and they turned actually the opposition into a more jihadi opposition by allowing jihadist fighter to come up to Syria. So here we have to deal with a very actually globalized phenomenon. We tend to forget that it has to do with, it's a crisis of globalization. It's an illustration of globalization. I mean, the dark side of globalization today. That's why it's extremely complicated, for example, to say that Salafism or jihadism are two realities that are explainable through only one or two factors. There is a plurality of factors actually that we have to be to bear in mind when we want to study Salafism and jihadism.
Yeah, yes, of course. But you refer, so you said the jihadis are in where fighting is taking place, but you also mentioned foreign fighters and the failure of globalization. So my question was rather, where do those foreign fighters come from? For instance, in Syria, where do they come from, and what is their background, would you say?
Well, they come from almost any region in the world. Maybe the only two regions actually that didn't export jihadi fighters to Syria are Latin America, and we can discuss this, and the Far East, countries like Japan, for example. But the rest of the regions, the rest of the world has been pretty good at sending actually jihadist fighters. France is a really very interesting case. Belgium, Tunisia, Kazakhstan, for Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Kosovo, for example. So not necessarily always Muslim majority countries. And another issue that I would like to highlight here is that Salafism and jihadism are very visible trends within Islam. So it is that it has to do sometimes with the issue of migrants, but also maybe even more frequently with the issue of converted people. We tend to forget that these two branches of Islam today, they are pretty good at attracting non-Muslim people. So, for example, according to my studies, in a country like France, Salafism, almost around 30%, almost one third of the Salafists that we find in France, they were born in a non-Muslim family. So it's really interesting. So there is not necessarily a connection between being a migrant family or an immigrant family and having some interest in Salafism, for example. It's much more complicated. So that's why actually these traditional explanations in terms only of identity crisis, in terms of feeling disconnected from the country of origin, it's interesting. I'm not necessarily denying it. I mean, there is no connection, but it's also more diverse, much more different, actually, in terms of new explanations. We feel clearly on the ground today, if you study Salafism, that not only people coming from a Muslim family are attracted to Salafism. I mean, friends, 30% of the people who are part of Salafist group or Salafist community were born in a non-Muslim family. Some countries, it's even higher, for example. In India is a very interesting case. You have a huge Muslim population in India. Don't you agree? A huge one, probably the second Muslim population in the country worldwide. And we have only around 400 radicalized people. Most of them are converts. So how do we explain that? More than a half of the Indian people who are jihadists today, they do not come from actually a Muslim family. They come from a Hinduist family. So it's really interesting to have in mind the possible connections between being a migrant or having a kind of immigrant background and sticking to certain form of radical Islam. But it's much more complicated actually on the ground than we could expect.
Yeah. Nevertheless, 70% of Salafi come from a Muslim background in France under the statistics. But if we zoom in on those on the jihadis, they come from all regions of the world except Latin America and the Far East. They come from Muslim majority countries and from Muslim minority countries. So it's extremely difficult here to see a pattern in any case. And so the question is, so the factors that we have mentioned so far are the social conditions in the countries in which those people live, which can be related to marginalization. We mentioned that to appearing inferior, and Salafism gives you a sense of self-respect that you didn't have. But if we zoom in, yes, on jihadism and no longer on Salafism, because as you have well said, they don't overlap. And there is not even a clear over-representation of Salafi among jihadis. So what, according to you, are the main factors of jihadism, differentiating those who come from Muslim majority countries and those who come from Muslim minority countries?
That is a very tough question. Actually, I doubt that someone could ever give you the whole bunch of reasons why people they may hold on to jihadism. However, we have certain, let's say, we don't have any pattern, but we have certain similarities. Certain regular characteristics. For example, in the case of Europe, we have we found out that 51% of the people of the European jihadist people, actors, they had a kind of criminal background, more than a half. So they already had a kind of previous socialization within a criminal circle. So it was not necessarily a jihadist circle or a religious one, but they had a certain mastery, for example, of some attitudes, they knew how to handle with weapons. They already had a kind of experience in jail or in prison in many countries, like in France, for example, but also in Germany as well as some other places. That's a bit different in, for example, North Africa. In a country like Morocco, for example, there is some clear evidence, for example, that poverty is really a driving force. Actually, for example, people from the very marginal places, suburban places, actually from a very poor background, they have turned actually to Salafism, to jihadism at some point. So you don't necessarily have, a global pattern, but you have some common characteristics. Yeah,
there seems to be a pattern that people in Muslim minority countries who turn to jihadism have a background of immigrants, 51%, you say, in the French case.
And criminal background,
yes. And people in Muslim majority countries have more of a poverty background. But it seems to me the two are related. That is, the people, those with a criminality background in Muslim minority countries, I suppose, are also overrepresented among the lower income groups in those countries. And does it mean that if there is those jihadi people in Muslim majority countries, they turn to jihadism while coming from poor social groups, but they had not resorted to they had not been involved in criminality like people in more Muslim minority countries like France had been?
Well, briefly speaking, yes. I mean, because you have, let's say, different kinds of different.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt you about that. So, yes. So, does it mean that, because that seems to me important, that those people in them, you refer to the jihadism as being a failure of globalization. So, I will make my point, and I will make my. The dark side, yes. I will make my point and you will tell me what you think about that. So can we say that all those jihadi people are to some extent fighting against some form of globalization? And those in Muslim majority countries, their main target are not domestic. They are international. They are foreign. And that's why they turn to jihadism, but they do not have a domestic criminal background. Whereas those in Muslim minority countries, generally in the West, they are violent against targets that are in their country. And that's why there is an overlap between criminality, domestic criminality, and international jihadism in their case, but not in the other.
Actually, I would say both, actually, because the diversity of possible targets, it really depends on the trajectories, the journeys, but also the ideology of the groups that are sponsoring actually some terrorist attacks. I mean, in France, for example, we have seen that diverse profiles have been targeted: police forces, civilians, Jewish communities, for example, but also Muslim people, for example, for instance. So there is a diversity of possible targets. And of course, we have, I mean, possibly, I mean, the main one, which is going to a certain field of battle, like Syria, for example, and trying to be part of this struggle of a national uprising against a regime that the jihadist forces have contributed to turn into a jihadi, a religious conflict, both as a cause and also as a consequence of what happened at the time in Syria. So it's a very complicated issue, because it's not because actually that you go to Syria that you cannot come back to France and undertake a terrorist attack. You can do both. And on the other side, you can also go to Syria in order actually to help the Syrian people. That's what some people said, actually, amongst jihadists. And you would never harm, actually, French people. So we have a diversity, actually, of trajectories, of journeys, of jihadist experiences. So it makes someone like me extremely, and many scholars, by the way, many colleagues, pretty uncomfortable in saying that there is only one pattern and saying that it works this way and not another way. So it's more and more complicated, more and more, let's say, sophisticated in terms of jihadist journeys. It's also, for example, the same for the issue of poverty. Yeah, it does matter. I would say it does matter in many places, but that's not the only factors. We have seen also people from the Gulf with a pretty decent background, economically speaking, and they join ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So what we can say, if I had to, let's say, if I wanted to make a step forward, at least, or to try to, I would say that their similarity is a kind of imaginary. All of them are not necessarily very observant. They are not necessarily, maybe they may be poor sometimes, but not necessarily poor. the issue of Salafism and jihadism, you said it, is not necessarily a mechanical one. But what for sure they have in common, they all do believe that Islam is a political nation which is under threat. There is a kind of insecurity paradigm. What is today, for example, the only ideology or the only ideologies that could drive some people from one country to the other side of the world, except jihadism? I don't see any other one.
Fight, you mean?
In order to fight, of course, yes. I mean, if you have to compare with other journeys...
You can think of the U.S. Army as well.
The U.S., yes. U.S. Army, it is violence, but it is an institutionalized form of violence. Jihadism is not necessarily an institutionalized form of violence, except if you consider that ISIS, for example, has tried to build a state. It was a kind of state-building process, really, a kind of utopian state-building process. So in this case, ISIS was really a revolution. It was a huge change in the jihadist narratives. But if you allow me just to finish on this, maybe the only thing that you could, according to me, compare to jihadist people in terms of migrations, of course, not of violence, I'm talking about migrations, are the people who want to go somewhere else in order to make a better living. You know, for example, people leaving Morocco, leaving African countries, leaving so many countries in the world, for example, in order to join the West or another region, in order, for example, to get a job, to get better living standards. So there is a kind of jihadist migrations. Jihadism is based on migrations, actually. When you go somewhere in order to fight, that's, of course, substantially different from going somewhere else for another reason. But it is still, you can study jihadism as a kind of set of different migrations. It's a good case for migration studies, violent migration studies. And some people look at the number of women that joined actually jihadist groups in the Middle East, because they wanted sometimes to fight, but at least they wanted to be part of a certain utopian building process. They wanted to be part of the pure Islamic society, ideal Islamic society building. So it's extremely interesting. I mean, of course, we can see that jihadism is really violent, focused on huge radical forms of violence. But it would be, to me, a bit harming, actually, to consider only this dimension, because we also have, I mean, other sources of comparison, like migrations, like utopia, like, for example, some people, they wanted to go to Syria to be part of the Islamic State because they wanted a job. They thought, actually, that ISIS leaders will provide with jobs, with good working conditions, with salaries. And imagine, for example, that we have seen people from Tunisia going to Syria and Iraq in order actually to have a better job. So not necessarily to fight first. So it's a really complicated issue, a very sophisticated issue that needs to be that needs to make us, I mean, extremely humble and modest when it comes to studying this issue.
Yes, but if we come back to the factors of this, so the pattern, as you said, is that those people think that Islam as a nation is under threat and needs to be protected. And this is what gives some form of unity to what they do. They fight against the Assad government. They can perpetrate terrorist attacks in Nigeria or even in France. So this common element seems to imply what I was saying earlier, that this violence is both domestic violence and an international violence for those coming from Muslim minority countries, whereas it's strictly a form of international violence for those coming from domestic, from those coming from Muslim majority countries. That is, because you refer to Tunisians, for instance, saying that they have less of a criminal background than French jihadists, for instance. So what I am trying to find out is that this threat is, can we say that this threat comes from the West in this thinking?
No, not necessarily. It can, at a very practical level. You know, there is a strong level of agency within jihadist people because they sometimes, of course, look at another, at the sociology of terrorist attacks, for example. Some of them, they are completely designed from the Middle East. They are funded, they are designed, they are sponsored, they are conceptualized right from the Middle East, from, I mean, someone in the Middle East, in Syria, Iraq, for example, organizing a terrorist attack in Paris. We have seen that. But some other cases, actually, they show or they illustrate the fact that there is a strong level of agency. They had some people, for example, that were connected to ISIS, for example, not only, but for example, to ISIS. They designed their own terrorist attack. There was, I mean, you know, this all this debate on lone wolves. Well, we can discuss the relevance of this concept, but the point is that strategically, they were given the order, or actually the idea of an attack that could harm a policeman or policewoman in the street, civilians, for example. We have seen that in a supermarket. Have you seen, for example, what happened in some Christmas markets in Europe a few years ago, in Strasbourg, in Germany, for example? So it's a bit like there is a kind of strong agency, because here in this case, it's really aimed at making people fearful, making people afraid, terrified, actually. The violence, the jihadi violence, it was likely, actually, or is still likely, actually, to harm, to target anyone, anywhere, anytime. And here, clearly, you have a design which is built on the desire to frighten the Western public opinions, the Western populations. So you have different types, different levels, actually, of violence and conflictuality. It will be extremely difficult, actually, to summarize the whole and to say that there is only one characteristic. But what I think is that we are going through an increasingly diverse set of and intrications of violence or violences.
Yes, but that the fear or creating scare is a mean. It's not the cause of the violence. That is you and it generally is the instrument of the when you have a big asymmetry in power, you will generally resort to this terrorism. Is an instrument, actually, of violence to wage a war against an opponent. I mean, jihadism in the West is a form of reflection of the social conditions of Muslims in those countries. That is because, as you say, it's not Islam in itself that leads to violence. It's rather the social context in which Islam is practiced that can lead some people into violence. And some of them are violent already before because they have this criminal background. So I still keep in mind that if we want to understand this violence, we need to understand the social conditions of Muslims in those countries. Otherwise, we are not providing a deep explanation of that. But if we go back to history, so as you say, Islam dates back to the 7th century, and however, do you think that today we are in a period in which jihadism is more prevalent at the global level than it was in other periods in the history of Islam?
Well, I mean, the last few decades have been clearly have provided with huge opportunities for the birth, the emergence, and the consolidation of jihadism, but also for the crisis of jihadism. Because today, for example, I give one of the most striking examples is that ISIS no longer exists as a state or a wannabe state. So for a few years, we had this feeling, this impression that there was a state in the Middle East that would be built, or that was built upon the idea of restoring the famous caliphate. Okay. Was it an Islamic state or not? That's another issue. But the branding was clearly, was this one. The idea now is to reflect in terms of possible new evolutions for jihadism. Many experts, for example, they tend to say today that the Middle East is less impacted than it used to be until recently. Africa, the Francophone Africa, for example, Mali and other countries like that, they provide with the new land, new room. They provide with new room for jihadist opportunities. For example, Mali, for example, Nigeria, and a few Western Africa could be, for example, it's still to some people, it's already the case. It could be increasingly in the future, in the near future, the place where the game happens, where the game takes place, the jihadist game takes place. So other countries, for example, many countries could, provide with some opportunities. And here we have, of course, to connect the issue of jihadism with the issue of failed state or state of concern, state that are facing some issues today in terms of sovereignty, in terms of capacity of containing or rolling back these movements. So clearly here we have a kind of good discussions. We need a good discussions on the resistance of some states to the jihadist threat, clearly. So it's extremely complicated at the end of the day, because we know that jihadist narratives are still very popular in some spheres, wherever in the world, in Europe, in North America, in the Middle East, in Central Asia, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, for example. The question is now, how strong, when, how strong is it, how still strong is the jihadist narrative in some places, okay? Because we may have in the future other terrorist attacks, other conflicts, other Islamic State experiences, for example, we can have that. But the question is, what are going to be the circumstances under which these new jihadist experience are going to happen, are going to take place? And here, of course, the debate is clearly open. We don't know yet.
I think the key word is circumstances. So, because, that's probably something you are less knowledgeable about. But what about the 17th century, the period from the 17th century to the mid-20th century? Was jihadism important during this period, let's say from 1600 to 1945? Was there important?
No, clearly. I would even say that jihadism as the ideology that we know today was not even existing. It was not born yet, actually. We have different narratives over this issue of jihad in the Islamic societies. For example, in the colonial period was extremely rich in terms of jihadist or jihad-based narratives. The idea that, for example, some countries, some Islamic or Muslim people, they could use this narrative in order to free themselves. We have seen this in Algeria against the French occupation, for example, the French colonization. We had secular parties actually claiming that jihad was a huge to create this rally around the flag, the rally around the Algerian flag phenomenon, in order to get rid of the French colonization. They used actually some religious references like jihad. We see that also in Palestine today, where you have some non-religious people. They say that on behalf of jihad, they have the right to fight with the Israelis or the Israeli occupation, for example, and colonization. So clearly, this tradition. This, because jihad is a very complex concept, actually, that could refer to a variety of meanings, according to Islamic scholars, from charity to fighting, from solidarity to seeking more or wanting to achieve scientific success. Jihad is really complex in itself, as a notion, as a religious concept. But jihadism in itself is pretty recent. The jihadism, this kind of jihadism that I've been talking about, for now almost 1 hour, it's something that was born, that was designed in the 70s and the 80s, actually. So it's a kind of 40-45-year-old ideology. So it's pretty, recent. It's pretty new. It's pretty young. And the idea now is to understand what has made this ideology successful. And clearly, it was not actually, it was not a state oriented jihad. It was a privatized form of jihad because, as I mentioned, with Afghanistan, we had people coming to Afghanistan and they designed a new ideology, actually, in order actually to be able to legitimate the fact that they could hit any enemy of Islam anywhere, anytime, anyone. It's completely new.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. So let's move on now. We had the first discussion, which was the relationship between Salafism and jihadism. And then we understood that this was not There was no overlap between the two. Then we moved to trying to explain jihadism in itself. And so I think the best explanation is the explanation of the circumstances. That is, circumstances which may have to do with social marginalization, with just also the balance of power. In case of a failed state somewhere, you have this attempt to use violence also that becomes more straightforward. Now let's move to a third discussion, which is why did we have this rise of this movement in particular, and the connection between Salafism, jihadism, and also migration over the last four decades, and or four or five decades. And you say something that was quite interesting, that is that Assad, the government of Bashar al-Assad, encouraged the Islamization of the opposition as a way to discredit it. So
jihadization of the uprising, actually.
Yes, the jihadization of the uprising as a way to discredit it. So to what extent is do you think is putting forward relationships between Salafism and jihadism, and also identifying a movement as jihadism, to what extent do you think it's also an external identification? That is, you may have groups that have an interest in confusing the boundaries the boundaries between Salafism and jihadism, or that may have an interest in having a radical Islam that is easier to isolate and dominate.
No, for sure. I mean, you have a variety of factors once again. So, I mean, I told you I doubt that anyone, any scholar, any person could give you the whole explanation, provided there is one explanation or one kind of one bunch of key explanations. We can assume, and we can see actually empirically, what we are looking for as researcher is empirical data. For example, are foreign interventions important when it comes to explaining the rise of jihadist groups sometimes in some places? For example, the manipulation, the instrumentalization of some authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, for example, have they been key in allowing jihadist forces to reinforce, as we have seen that in Syria, for example? In the case of Syria, that's pretty well documented, actually. We have public decisions that were actually made in order to release many jihadist people who were in prison before. And when the uprising started, these jihadist fighters, actually, they were able to join the uprising and to turn it into a more radical, more violent one, you know? And of course, Assad was extremely interested in this. Actually, he was the one who designed this policy, but we've seen that before. I mean, in the 90s in Algeria, we have good reasons to see to assume that actually some jihadist groups have been used in certain ways in order actually to make the population and the public opinion, when I say public opinion, the Algerian one, but also the global one, the international one, look at what's happening in Algeria. You have to support us as a regime because we are fighting actually radical extremist groups. So you have to side with us. So clearly here it's also pretty well documented. It doesn't mean that there is no jihadist rationality, there is no jihadist narrative, no jihadist ambitions. Of course there are. But the point is that it's a kind of combination of different factors. I can also add one: Western countries as well, because, for example, I mentioned in this conversation between you and me many times, I mentioned the war in Afghanistan in the 80s. In the 80s, these people were seen as freedom fighters. We should not forget that. The idea that these people, on behalf of the same ideology, of the same ambitions, they were seen as good fighters, good people wanting to get rid of the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. On their side, they were fighting for another agenda. Afghanistan was not Afghanistan. Afghanistan was an Islamic territory that had to be freed actually by Muslims and Muslims fighters. So clearly you can see that, of course, it's you also have, I mean, in terms of practicalities, if we are very pragmatic, it's a bunch of different, let's say, circumstances, as you said, that do combine and interact with each other in order, or so they can generate some successes for the jihadist people.
Yes, but I mean, this, as we were discussing about the episode where we were discussing whether the word jihadism was Western-centered or not. So it seems to me that the very question that we are asking is related to some extent to violence taking place to those who exert this violence, but is related as well to an attempt at categorizing this violence in other countries. That is, the notion of jihadism, you may know more than me about that, but it's a Western notion. It's a notion that has emerged in Western countries over the last decades as a negative as part of a negative approach to Islam, and it includes in itself this idea, and that's why it became related also to Salafism. It includes this idea that there is something mechanical in at least a variant of Islam that leads to violence, but that Islam, even though it's a variant, Islam includes its variants. So, to what extent the very parameters of the debate are shaped not only by the violence of some Muslims, but also by the violence of non-Muslims against Muslims, and the attempt of identifying those people as necessarily violent without taking care of the particular circumstances that can lead to this violence is itself a form of violence. So the very debate we are engaging in is just a minefield in a violence between some Muslim groups and non-Muslim groups, which may be itself related to some state-building project, to some state boundaries question, to also migration.
Mm-hmm. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're asking here about how jihadism could be the language through which some other non-religious issues are framed.
Yeah, through which non-Muslims refer to the violence of others, and in this way also are part of a conflict with them.
No, I mean, for sure. I mean, jihadism, this ideology, this narrative, this sort of doctrinal construction. For sure, it has always been able actually to frame non-religious, non-stricto sensu religious issues into jihadized, let's say, paradigms, actually, for sure. I give you one, some conflicts, or most of the conflicts actually, a majority of conflicts in this region actually were born a non-religious way. I mean, for example, look at Palestine, look at the Arab uprisings. It's first of all societies wanting to overthrow some authoritarian regimes like in Syria and other countries like that. So clearly here it's part of a broader equation, and jihadist groups are successful, are smart enough, and they can strategize on how, for example, they can investigate some conflicts or some social dynamics, for example, in Africa. In Africa, you also have in Mali this issue of the northern part of the Azawad, actually, which is not actually a religious claim. It is a kind of claim for, I mean, autonomy or even independence. And sometimes you have a jihadization of this non-religious narrative. Or, for example, in Europe, you have mentioned Europe many times, you have some social dynamics, actually, that find with jihadism a certain imaginary through which people can identify. But initially, for example, how bad relations can be between, for example, some migrants and their families and their children and grandchildren, how bad their relations can be with the rest of the society, it's not necessarily something that is religious. And very often it's far from religion. However, you have a certain process which is the Islamization in a radicalized form here, the Islamization of non-Islamic issues, non-Islamic connections between one individual or one group and the rest of the society, clearly. Yeah.
Yes, but that's what I meant. That is, if we take jihadism from the Western point of view or from the non-Muslim point of view at large, it's itself an instrument of almost war. It's this concept, because if you start using this concept and if you start identifying other people as jihadists, then it allows you to set national regulations, national legislation, and possibly international military operations in order to fight them.
I mean, here you're tackling a very interesting issue, which is this one, and correct me once again if I'm wrong. Does the response to jihadism play a role? Does it, for example, reinforce or weaken jihadism? That's a very good question. Is it your question?
Yes, but exactly also as you said about Assad, that is, he had an interest in being able to categorize the opposition to his regime as Islam, jihadist, because if he can do that, he can get international support. And and likewise, take a country like France, for instance. You know very well political debates in France. If you put forward jihadism, you can bring forward a series of legislative steps that may actually reinforce the segregation that we were talking initially, that may support foreign intervention, that in turn can reinforce jihadism. So there was this. Yes, go on.
At least that's what some people fear. Some intellectuals, political leaders, media people, journalists, some associations, for example. Have you seen what some human rights associations have been saying when it comes, for example, to the French response, or even before that, actually? For example, after September 11, the Patriot Act in the US, or can we ask ourselves, for example, has the global war on terror initiated with Bush, has it reinforced, for example, jihadism worldwide? You know, I mentioned the importance of empirical data. September 11, which is of course a key date, a key bloody date, actually, in the history of jihadism, in the history of violence, in the history of the US, also in global history, by the way. We had maybe one jihadist hub. We had Afghanistan at some point, and a bit Sudan. We are in 2001, after September 11, so 2001. Today, 20 years, a bit more than 20 years after this event, okay, we have like what, almost one hub, or at least, or maybe sometimes many hubs, many jihadist hubs within many countries, perhaps 30, 40, 50 countries worldwide. Malaysia, Indonesia, France, Morocco, Mauritania, Libya, Yemen, Syria, Turkey, Kazakhstan, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a case of the global war on terror does explain this? It's a question. It's a much more complicated story. But how, for example, we have never been that harsh in fighting with jihadism or trying to contain jihadism, and we never had as many jihadists as today, for example, jihadist fighters, and the jihadist appeal has never been stronger than today at some point. Okay, so here, do we find a connection? Is it something which is independent? I don't know. I mean, as a scholar or as scholars, we need to question this. But clearly, if you want to reflect in terms of interactions, interperceptions, clearly, I would say that, for example, when you don't solve a conflict, when you push for certain type of stigmatizations of a religion, when you give the impression, even if it's not initially your purpose, that you oppress some people, some communities in some countries, that's never good, according to me. Because a key response, a good response to, for example, this jihadist challenge would be simply social integration and political integration. Okay, it may be seen as naive. Why not? Okay, why not? But I go for that. The idea, actually, that a better understanding of what social and political integration really means actually could be a good answer, actually a good response to this jihadist challenge. And of course, the debate is once again here is open, and we have so many things to discuss when it comes to the best ways, the best options when it comes to fighting and trying to challenge jihadism.
Yes, of course. But what is, I think, is key here is the idea that those who attack jihadism are actually part of the same violent dynamic as the jihadists themselves. That is, they are advocates of violence, like George W. Bush or some French politicians. And by doing so, they reinforce, they are part of the same system of exerting violence, and this violence just reinforces each other until a point where we'll have major conflagration.
I'm not saying this is the same. Maybe, I mean, a question.
It's not the same, but they are part of a single system of violence.
I'll give you just an example. When you have a terrorist attack, a bloody one, okay, and no one wants to suffer from any terrorist attacks, of course, when you have some voices standing and saying, we expect of every Muslim, we expect of every Muslim that they stand up and speak up in order to denounce jihadist violence. What does it mean? It may be seen as positive in the mind of the persons, I mean, initiating this kind of claims. But for example, it means that many people would be or would see, would be, they could be, they could feel authorized, they could feel entitled to consider that there is one single Islamic community, one single global Islamic identity, and that everyone knows each other, and that Muslims were aware of the jihadist threat and they didn't warn the society, okay? Which actually on the ground is not true at all. But with this, for example, questions or with these claims, you could generate. There is a risk in generating this idea, this impression that all Muslims actually are partners in crimes. And they are pretty well, let's say, they have good feelings about jihadism. And they have to show us, they have to make the demonstration that they split. There is a divide between them and the rest of, I mean, and the jihadist groups, which is actually extremely, I would say, perverse. As a warning, as a message that you're sending to the Muslim communities, and of course to the rest of the society, the non-Muslim parts of the society.
Yes, and so this and then we have come full circle. That is, that the very equation that should we find some mechanical links between Salafism and jihadism, or between Islam in any form and violence, is itself part of a rhetorical instrument, a rhetorical weapon in a struggle, in a fight, in a series of violent confrontations. So that, yes, you have the anti-jihadists, politicians are themselves part of the same system in which violence just gets stronger and stronger. And as you said, in 2022 today, the jihadist threat had never been as strong, at least in the last 40 years. And in the past, it was something completely different. In any case, when it was taking place, I think here we come back to this this overall idea that it's a failure of globalization, but one in which states and violent groups have been partnering in crime. Maybe it's a very big statement to say that, but they just reinforce each other. And you mentioned Afghanistan at the beginning, and you. The United States was also, you have been working on these issues, the United States was also funding Bin Laden at that time, this time directly, before turning against him. And actually, when they turned against him, it made him even stronger than when they were funding him. They killed him, actually, but his movement became stronger.
Yes, because I mean, even if we want to focus once again on this jihadist appeal, I mean, what makes, for example, some jihadist narratives at least part of them, successful? Is it bad politics, identity, religion, faith, ideology? Who knows? Clearly, I doubt once again that you will ever find one guy, one scholar who is going to give you the perfect explanation. I doubt that very strongly. But we can ask questions. For example, I mean, do we have any, I don't think there is any pattern, any model, but we have, let's say, for example, some, let's say, similarities. So clearly the first one that I would find is clearly the idea that Islam is under threat. It's a political religious nation, okay? So there is a part of ideological construction, of course, but the idea actually that I can fight and I can die for someone actually who is in Syria, and I being French or being Canadian or being Indonesian. So what is the ideology today that drives thousands of people worldwide from one country to another, from one extremity of the world to another, in order to die? Can you see another one? I mean,
no, not so, no, but army. I was mentioning the U.S. Army before. But
you mentioned the U.S. soldiers, which is true, but from a different standpoint. But I mean, a non-institutionalized force, violent force.
Yes, yes. But just, I think that what is striking is that both sides call out the threat from the others. Both sides are saying, oh, we are threatened.
And so they threaten.
And it's a system, and it's a series of cycles.
No, I mentioned many times in this conversation the importance of interactive processes. But
yes,
I mean, when I say, for example, that jihadism is exceptional, at some point, it's different at some point. But some people would argue some other way. Today, for example, we have some people, like we had in the past, going to Spain in the interwar period in order to fight. We have some people going to Ukraine today in order to fight. In favor of the Ukrainian people. Some people fight for the Russians, by the way. So this idea of foreign fighting phenomena, it's not necessarily a jihadist phenomenon.
No.
So, of course, by the way, we have some jihadist people. They fight for the Ukrainians against the Russians. We have seen that as well, because they have a very good... a deal to set with Putin, as everybody knows. So clearly, I mean, all this, that's why the issue of globalization is also a very good angle through which we can try to go in depth with this issue of jihadism. So is it about what? Sociology of violence? How, for example, political violence has been now reframed actually, in order, I mean, to provide with new or to generate new patterns, new models. We'll see. But clearly here we have, I mean, food for thought when we want to study.
No, but yes, maybe we can conclude on this and stop here. But my insights, you're free not to share it, is that violence calls for violence. Violence triggers violence. In a series of steps. And so the solution to that is to find a social system that minimizes violence all the way, if possible. That is, find a social system in which coercion, which is violence, coercion is minimized. And if you don't do that, because violence is a Pandora box, violence triggers violence, then you end up in a spiral. Yes, it's a spiral. I don't know where the spiral is going to stop. If my guess is that the history of jihadism is not over. It has not ended with the wars in Afghanistan. The killing of Bin Laden. It has not ended even with the vast apparatus in France meant to prevent terrorist attacks. I think it's not over. I think it will continue somehow and may even reach a breaking point at some point. Anyway, last word, Mohamed, and we will stop here.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I mean, you can see that the debate is still... not only open, it's still vibrant. Let me put it this way. Final word.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Mohamed. No, and I will share the picture of your book one last time. So it's available at Palgrave Macmillan, and it's titled Understanding Salafism in the series on international relations and political economy. All right. Thank you very much. And take care. Bye-bye.